This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Meera Nair, is a film director who grew up in India and has made several films about India and Indians in America, including Salaam Bombay, Mississippi Masala, and Monsoon Wedding. She also made the adaptation of the Thackeray classic Vanity Fair. Nair's new movie, The Namesake, is adapted from the best-selling novel by the Pulitzer Prize-winning Indian-American writer Jhumpa Lahiri. The film is about a man and woman who enter an arranged marriage in Calcutta and then move to New York and raise two children. The children grow up immersed in American pop culture and American values about love and sex, so there's a lot that the parents and children don't understand about each other's lives. The son is named Gogol, after the Russian author, but the name is so unusual it's always been a source of embarrassment for him, and he's never understood why his father chose it until this scene, when his father explains how the name relates to a train crash he survived before he was married.
It was 1974. I was a student in Calcutta. Every year I would take the train to visit my grandfather in Jamshedpur. I carried one book with me to read on the journey.
Gogol?
Yes. The overcoat. So on the train, late at night, Mr. Ghosh befriended me. And he kept trying to persuade me to leave India. And I just wanted to get back to my book. My grandfather always says that is what books are for, to travel without moving an inch. And that's when it happened. I kept hearing Ghosh's voice in my head.
Pack a pillow and blanket. See the world. You will never regret it.
That is how I came to America, and you got your name.
Meera Nair, welcome back to Fresh Air. The Namesake is about many things, but you've described it as being about the death of a parent in a foreign country. And of all the things that happen in the movie, I'm wondering why that's such a defining moment for you.
I guess it was it's what inspired me to make this beautiful novel into a film. It was inspired by grief and melancholy. I read this novel by chance on a plane in a period when I was in abject mourning for losing my mother-in-law, who died of medical malpractice in a New York hospital, kind of unexpectedly. And in our custom, we bury almost the next day, and sort of found ourselves burying her in a freaky snowstorm in New Jersey. And it was in my first, experience of the finality of death and loss like that. All the more tough because I never expected it at all. And I read The Namesake purely by chance on a plane, 6 weeks after this. I was just absolutely captured by the distillation of Jhumpa's writing, of especially the death of a parent. And I felt like I had found solace. I had found a person in the world who understood exactly what I was feeling. So that was the first kind of recognition, or the first feeling of this fever that I had to make this novel into a film. But then on rereading and rethinking before the plane even landed, it was that and more than that.
When you optioned The Namesake, you knew how you resonated with certain experiences in the book, but did you want to also learn about the author's experiences more directly? Did you talk with her directly and meet members of her family?
Well, I knew Jhumpa a little bit from Interpreter of Maladies. She had talked to me about the possibility of directing one of the short stories, and we knew each other very briefly. But of course, as soon as I came back to the States, I met with her and told her, more than asking her what her experience was, I told her my vision of The Namesake as a film, which really made her, to use her word, ecstatic. And only after that, after she gave me the book, which was within a week of my reading it, it seemed, only when I was deeply entrenched in it, I insisted that I spend a weekend with her family, her parents in Rhode Island, who are, in Jhumpa's own admission, sort of, she channeled, especially her mother, to write the character of Ashima, the mother in The Namesake. And I loved Mr. and Mrs. Lahiri. You know, they became like my own uncle and aunt, kind of. And meeting them and even being in their home was a great model for how I wanted this film to look and feel. And the first thing I made Tabu and Irfan Khan, the actors who play Ashok and Ashima, do when they came to the States months later to shoot this film, was to spend a day with the Lahiris. And that was a key for them to understand how to interpret the character.
Tell me something that you got from spending time with Jhumpa Lahiri's parents.
You know, the feeling of her father, who is a librarian and a very self-effacing man, deeply intellectual, deeply erudite, but completely as if, you know, a quiet presence, never someone to assert himself or to make himself heard, but by his own kind of contentment and the love in him, you know, you gravitate towards him. He's strongly sure of who he is and doesn't need to brandish anything about himself. And that was a very important quality that Irfan had to adopt for to play the role of Ashok. Her mother is a lot like as she is described in the book as Ashima, also someone who's incredibly cultured, very knowledgeable about Bengali movies and about movies in general, about songs, about... I talked with her a lot. You know, for instance, even the lullabies that I had Ashima sing in the film are all lullabies that Mrs. Lahiri sings to her grandchildren. I wanted to make the film as personal to the Lahiri family as Monsoon Wedding was to my family.
Now, in the movie The Namesake and in the novel as well, the parents in the story have an arranged marriage. And although their relationship is pretty formal with each other by a lot of American standards, and they're not given to emotional displays, they are very deeply in love. And falling and staying in love is actually much more difficult for their son, who was born in America and grew up in America. And relationships for him are much less permanent, even when he thinks they're going to be permanent. Now, you made a movie about an arranged marriage, Monsoon Wedding, and I'm wondering if your views on arranged marriages have changed over the years.
Well, you know, I'm very intrigued by arranged marriage. I'm not a candidate for arranged marriage myself. I've never had an arranged marriage. But my brothers have, for instance, and, you know, people very close to me have had very, very successful arranged marriages. Oftentimes, if one would put a statistic to it, oddly more successful than the so-called love marriage, although I haven't, you know, compared the two with any great study. But what intrigued me and what enchants me about the story of The Namesake partly is the fact of two people who choose each other to marry. They are set up by their families, but they are strangers to each other who then fall in love, you know. And that is a sort of the eros of that idea is very interesting to me. And for me, more than the book does, I very much was very clear that I wanted to rest my adaptation of The Namesake on two basic pillars. You know, one, the exquisite love story of an adult romance of Ashok and Ashima through the years, a romance that... a love story, really, that, like people I know of my parents' generation, who are content to be still, you know, who don't need roses and diamonds and Hallmark cards and I love yous and proclamations or public displays of love. But it's more about how one looks at each other over a cup of tea and the kind of a stillness and contentment between the two, which is in such stark contrast to Gogol's life and to all our lives today, you know, our multitasking sort of lives, which instant gratification kind of reigns supreme, you know. And
was there a period of your life when you didn't have as sympathetic a view toward at least some arranged marriages, when you thought that they were all like a terrible idea and you like fully rebelled against it?
Oh, I fully rebelled against it. I was one time I was 18 years old and my mother said that there was a proposal that came in from a big industrialist's family, and she said he'll be at such and such wedding and I want to introduce you. And for that wedding I borrowed my friend's outrageous flouncing gypsy skirt, and I had both my brothers, who are older than me, on either side of either arm, and I you know, sort of strode up to this father-in-law-to-be and said to him, "Meet my two boyfriends. I have no idea whom to go with tonight." And that settled that, you know. I was no longer a candidate for arranged marriage after that. So I'm completely rebellious against the arranged marriage for myself, you know. But I must say, you know, growing up and seeing the sort of permutations of it and seeing also some of the people who have completely ridden with it, you know, in a beautiful way, it's not as simple as we make it out to be.
What about your parents?
They had an arranged marriage completely and are separated. They're not together for the last, say, 15 years or so. But, you know...
They don't all work.
They were not. They don't all work at all. Of course not. But I also know many that have. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what was your parents' reaction when you pretended that your brothers were your boyfriends?
Oh, they just rolled their eyes and said, "Oh, Meera strikes again, you know." My nickname is Pugli, which means the crazy girl. And that was the act of a crazy girl.
Can I ask how you met your husband?
I met my husband in Kampala, Uganda, in 1989. I was researching a screenplay on the Asian expulsion from Uganda, and I had read a book that he had written called From Citizen to Refugee. He was a famous writer and academic, and I asked to interview him. And by chance, he had seen Salaam Bombay and loved it and agreed to be interviewed. And so he was one of many people that I was talking to in 1989, my first visit to the continent, in fact. And I have to say, it was a love at first sight. So 3 months later, we were together forever.
Since you grew up in India and not in Uganda, and your family wasn't part of the expulsion, the Asian expulsion from Uganda, what drew you to Uganda to make a movie about Indians who were forced to leave? Well, and this was the movie Mississippi Masala, and it's in working on that, as you explained, you met your husband.
Well, as an Indian student at Harvard, you know, in the late 70s, I was always interested in what I called the hierarchy of color, you know, of being brown in the middle of black and white. Mm-hmm. That I was sort of welcome in both communities, but there were also invisible lines. And I called it in my own way the hierarchy of color. And I wanted to make a film that was about this, about being brown in the midst of black and white. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading totally intellectually and completely, you know, completely in a cool way. I had never been to Africa, leave alone Uganda or the Asian expulsion. I didn't even know about it. But I remember reading about the Asian expulsion, where Idi Amin, you know, threw out a generation of Ugandan Asians who had never known India as their home, who had only known Uganda as their home, based on the color of their skin, largely, and give them 90 days to leave the country. And, you know, these were third generation, often, many of them. And how also the trick of history was such that many of these Ugandan Asians came to Mississippi, where they began to buy motels because they were very inexpensive. And also the weirdness was that in Mississippi, it was the birth of the civil rights movement. And I thought to myself, it was a complete fiction. What if, you know, a young girl who has grown up in Uganda, an Asian girl who thinks of herself as African, comes to Mississippi? As history had shown me, did happen. And what if she falls in love with an African American who also, like her, has never known Africa as his home?
In The Namesake, there's a cultural distance between the parents who come to the United States from India after they marry and their children who are born in the United States and are very, very American. They don't have that kind of formality in their relationships with other people that the Indian couple does. And the children's relationship with their parents is different than the children's friends' relationship with their parents. You know, like there's a nice scene where the son brings his girlfriend over to the house, and when she's introduced to his parents, she kisses them hello, and that's such a forward thing for them. I mean,
and she calls them by their first name.
And she calls them by their first name,
which is a shocking thing for an adult. You never refer in our culture. You never refer to any person who's older than you without a prefix or suffix. You know, an aunt or an uncle or Mrs. or some sign of respect.
So they're just like really they're not mean about it, but they're really just kind of taken aback and mm-hmm. like astonished mm-hmm. at how familiar she's being with them. And it seems to me you're kind of like culturally probably in the middle of all of this because you came here when you were how old?
I came here when I was 19.
So you're already pretty formed.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you came here, you know, you're a filmmaker, you're making movies, you're really so connected to people. But your son has grown up in three cultures.
Yes.
In Uganda and India and in the United States. So do you have that kind of like gap with him in terms of him being like more American or more Ugandan or whatever, and of being of a slightly like different culture than you are?
No, I like to think that he isn't. Firstly, he came to this country when he was 8 years old, which is, from living entirely in Uganda and then South Africa. And as I mentioned earlier, we live in three generations, whether it's in East Africa or in Manhattan. You know, they're always, his grandparents are with us. And we have a sort of rule that only Hindustani is spoken at home. We don't speak English at home.
Really?
And so he's very fluent in many languages, and he has a different accent for when he leaves the house, I have to say. But he's very interesting about that as well. And because he lives with his with the older generation, there's an enormous dimension to his both his relationship and his solicitous sort of looking after them, which I think is a huge something that the Americans have really cut off from their lives, which is a real lament for me. You know, how much an American family can gain from the presence of an older person with them. You know, it's so much a nuclear family here, so much just your mother, father, and your kid, you know. So Zoran is kind of, and also we live actively in Uganda as well, 3 months a year, and also in India, and it's like monsoon wedding in my house. You know, people are always coming and going from other places, from my brothers, their children, and so on. So he's part of a network, you know, that is, when Zoran goes to India, for instance, his cousins speak less Hindi than he does. You know, they speak English entirely, and he speaks Hindi at home in Manhattan.
You know, your movies, like several of them, do explore kind of like cultural connections, cultural identities. Living in three different cultures, as you do, in three different countries, as you do, Uganda, India, and the United States. As you get a little bit older, does your tie to any one country increase, you know, and as you think about where you want to spend most of your time?
I think that in about a few years, as my son begins to go to college and we are actively thinking of spending more time between Uganda and New Delhi in India, there's so much I want to do. I'm a gardener, for instance, in Uganda, and I'm really possessed by that, and I miss my garden. And I also have a film school in Uganda called Maisha, which is a Swahili word which means life. Every summer, we have a kind of boot camp for cinema where we give about 24 fellowships to students from Uganda, Kenya, Tanzania, and Rwanda, as well as India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh. And we bring in mentors, great screenwriters and great directors from everywhere, from Bollywood to Nigeria to Los Angeles to London. And they come together, much like a Sundance Lab here. We have a school because I believe that if we don't tell our own stories, no one else will tell them. And the Africa that we see on our screens is rarely made by an African. And so I'm very, involved with Maisha, and we want to build a center for it and so on. So it's a longer term dream that keeps me coming back, you know.
Did you grow up watching a lot of Bollywood films? And no?
Not at all. I grew up in a one-horse town, a tiny town with one Bhubaneswar, with one film theater, which consistently and forever showed Dr. Zhivago. And I had no interest or no idea that a film as a could be an interesting or important medium. You know, even Satyajit Ray's movies were unknown in India at that time. They were just not shown beyond Calcutta, in fact. And I saw an occasional Bollywood movie, but nothing I took desperately seriously. I mean, I would swoon over some of the romantic love songs, but the movies were not to be taken seriously, you know. My interest was political theater and street theater, which is what I got involved with in Calcutta, for instance, when I was 15. And I pursued that, you know. That was what I came to this country for, in fact, is to pursue, you know, engaged theater. And arrived at Harvard on a scholarship, and the theater was, you know, Oklahoma, hoop skirts and musicals, and had nothing to do with changing the world, you know. And so I had to choose something else that this university could give me. And through taking a course in photography, stumbled into documentary filmmaking, which was a great blessing because at an age of like 20, 21, I had found my place in the world.
Making fiction films now, has it given you more respect for the hoopskirt musicals like Oklahoma?
Actually, Oklahoma came back to haunt me because my son Zoran was cast as the lead, Curly, in his school play of Oklahoma. So I, you know, wake up singing, "Oh, what a beautiful morning," and it's hilarious. That is the same play that drove me out of the theater is now what I'm living with. But well, yeah, I mean, making narrative film, one has greater respect for so many things.
Well, Mira Nair, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.